for the question, then realize I have no idea. She's right, of course. I couldn't be trusted with a baby. Neither could Wally. How foolish to even consider it. Rose stands and takes both my hands in her own.
I wish it were different, Fern. I really do.
I nod.
I'm here for you,
she says, wrapping her arms around me.
Now don't worry. We're going to figure this whole thing out. I promise.
I hold still, waiting for the hug to end. But Rose just continues to hold me, pinning my arms to my sides. I feel like I'm imprisoned, stuck, wearing a straitjacket.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. Fern is pregnant. The crazy thing is, this is an eventuality I've never considered. Sadistically, I can't help but think how different it would be if it were me who was pregnant. If I was suddenly carrying the baby I'd yearned for. Instead of being in damage control, we'd be celebrating. It's like the universe is playing a game with me, pushing me as hard as it can, seeing when I will break. I should be used to these kinds of curveballs in my life. Growing up, whenever I got used to one set of circumstances, something happened to throw me off. Like after Mum broke up with Gary. For a while, things were normal again. Better than normal. Living with Mum's moods seemed a small price to pay to be free of Gary's abuse. But things didn't remain normal for long. I'll never forget that morning when I was 12 and I woke up and heard Mum singing. Singing? It was too bizarre. Mornings were always quiet at our place. In our normal routine, Fern always woke first. Her body clock was very reliable. And then she would wake me. From there, we'd creep around the house, careful not to wake Mum. Mum was bad enough after a good night's sleep. We certainly didn't want to poke the bear by waking her up. But that morning, she was singing. As Fern and I slunk out of bed, even Fern was worried. My sister has always been a creature of habit, and this change to the routine didn't sit well with her. When we arrived in the kitchen, Mum beamed at us.
Good morning, beautiful girls. Who feels like eggs?
At 12, I was old enough to know about alcohol, and my first thought was that Mum must be drunk. Drinking didn't usually make her nicer, admittedly. But there had been a couple of times when she and one of her new friends shared a bottle of something, and she'd been something resembling warm toward me until the next morning.
But beautiful girls? Mum never said anything like that. She occasionally made comments about our looks, but only insofar as they referenced her own. You take after me, Fern, tall and skinny as you are. And then, of course, rosy round. But that day, we were beautiful.
She served us eggs, and we ate them in silence as she prattled on about the weather. Lovely. The day ahead. What are you girls doing at school? And the things we were looking forward to. Fern answered all of Mum's direct questions, agreeing that the weather looked nice. I remained suspicious. That afternoon, when Fern and I got out of school, Mum was waiting for us. That enough was cause for alarm. Mum didn't pick us up from school. She hadn't since we were 7. Her smile did nothing to comfort me. Mum always smiled in public.
Surprise!
Both Fern and I walked toward her slowly. She went for Fern first, picking her up and swinging her around in a way that parents did with much younger children. Fern went so stiff, it was as though Mum was spinning a metal rod. Finally, Mum let her go and took a deep, excited breath.
Girls, I have someone I'd like you to meet.
She turned and gestured toward a smiling man in jeans and a rugby jumper, leaning against a shiny silver car.
This, she said, is Daniel.
My blood ran cold. I knew that Mum wanted to find someone else. After she'd broken up with Gary, she got a computer and was always having Fern or me take her picture for one of those dating websites. Now, it appeared, She had found someone. "Daniel is a friend of mine," Mum said. "We've known each other since we were babies."
"So a long, long time," Daniel interrupted, grinning.
I glanced at Mum. If there was one thing she hated, it was people telling her she was old. But to my surprise, she laughed, a strangely pitched laugh that landed wrong somehow.
"I have been asking your mum if I could meet you for weeks, and finally she agreed," Daniel said. "You have a very protective mother."
To look at, Daniel did not seem intimidating. He was a few years older than Mum, I guessed, with the face of a soccer coach or trusted school teacher. He had no mustache, which was comforting, but only slightly. He gave an impression of being unpretentious, nice. Dad. The ones you saw on the telly.
I told him I don't introduce just anyone to my girls, but as he is such an old friend.
Enough of the old.
They both laughed. It was so strange. Mum even looked different. Her eyes danced. She looked beautiful. Her hair was in a ponytail, and it looked thick and shiny, and she was wearing a white spotted sundress that swished about her ankles.
"So I was thinking maybe Daniel could accompany us to the playground this afternoon. What do you say, girls? It's completely up to you."
Another bizarre thing. Mum never asked our permission about anything. As for the playground, I had a handful of memories of going to the playground when we were 5 or 6. But it had been years since Mum had taken us. She said that perverts loitered in public parks and that we must never go there. Fern and I were silent for so long that Mum laughed.
"My girls like to think these things over. They don't make rash decisions."
"You've taught them well," Daniel said.
"It's okay with me," Fern said eventually. And Daniel whooped and tried to give her a high five. But Fern just stared at his hand silently. I simply nodded, because what else was I supposed to do? I'm not sure if it was because Mum noticed my hesitation, or maybe because she didn't notice it, but as I made my way to the car, she intercepted me and started swinging me around like she'd done to Fern a few minutes earlier. I may have even drawn some comfort from the interaction, had I not noticed Mum glancing over my shoulder in Daniel's direction as she swung me, making sure he was watching.
Fern. On Monday morning, I go to work as usual. After the weekend of high drama with Rose, I derive some comfort from the normalcy of it, thinking a typical day is exactly what I need. However, I am sorely let down when I arrive in the staff room to find Carmel sitting at my desk. "It's shadow day," she says brightly. "I'm going to follow you as you work today."
I had completely forgotten about shadow day. And though I'm not opposed to it per se, I fear it will present an issue when it comes to ducking off to the secret cupboard intermittently for a nap, which is a shame. Because I'm tired today.
"You don't have to perform for me, Fern," she says when I don't say anything. "You should act as you would if I weren't in the library at all. Imagine I'm out of the office and you are in charge," she says with a little laugh. "All right," I say, when I see no viable way to protest. I place my backpack in the filing cabinet's empty bottom drawer and lock it. Then quickly scan my schedule and emails. After that, I head for the floor, Carmel hurrying after me. Out in the main library, I make my way to the children's section.
"I thought you were on the front desk this..."
Carmel starts, but instead of finishing her sentence, she gives herself a little shake.
"Sorry," she says. "Carry on."
I nod. My eye has already been drawn to a group of mothers in yoga pants, sitting cross-legged on the floor, drinking coffee and chatting. A few meters away, their toddlers happily pull books off the shelves and drop them in piles. I make a beeline for the kids.
"Would you like me to read you a story?"
I ask a little boy with red hair and pale blue eyes. He nods eagerly as a couple of the mothers glance over and start to apologize half-heartedly for the mess. I ignore them, pick up a copy of Incy Wincy Spider, and sit in a small wooden chair I've grabbed from a nearby aisle and begin reading. One by one, the other kids plant themselves at my feet. When I finish, a small girl hands me another book, and I read it. I read two more books before an elderly lady on a walking frame approaches.
Excuse me, Fern. I'm sorry to interrupt while you're reading, but I wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed Cat's Eye. I was utterly transported from start to finish.
The yoga mums have finished their coffee now, and they begin to load their kids back into their strollers. Amid a flurry of bleary-eyed thank yous from the mothers, I take the opportunity to stand, and Carmel, who has been sitting quietly nearby, does the same. I thought you'd like it, Mrs. Stevens, I say. Now that I have earned your trust, would you consider reading Margaret Atwood's novel The Blind Assassin? Follow me. I'll see if we have a copy in. Mrs. Stevens had been turned off by the title The Blind Assassin and refused to read it, so I'd had to lure her into the delights of Margaret Atwood the back way. I was still hopeful that she might enjoy Alias Grace or even The Handmaid's Tale if she was introduced slowly. Ah, here it is. Why don't I borrow this for you right now? The day goes quickly, and most of the time I don't even notice Carmel hovering. It's rather nice not even having to check my schedule for where I need to be. I simply roam the floor and go where I'm needed. To my surprise, Carmel doesn't stop me, not even once. She is a true shadow. At the end of the day, she sits on the edge of my desk and lets out a long sigh.
Wow, I never realized what a gift we had in the library.
I replay the sentence in my head, trying to make sense of what she is saying. Still, I come up blank.
You, Fern, she explains. You are the gift.
Unlike the shadow analogy, which I had come to respect, the gift analogy bears little logic. I find myself with questions. If I am the gift, who is the giver? And who is the receiver? And what is the occasion? But rather than help Carmel understand the failing in her logic, I decide to let it go. After all, Carmel has been a faithful shadow and hasn't once brought up the photocopiers, which, as far as I am concerned, is a win. At the dot of 5 o'clock, I place my backpack on my shoulders and start the walk home. It's my practice to walk home in silence, preferring my quiet thoughts to an audiobook as I wind down for the day. The evening is mild and there are people about, jogging, walking in groups of two or three, or pushing bulky strollers all over the pavement. I even pass a pregnant woman, carrying hand weights and walking briskly. It strikes me as ironic that it is at exactly the moment I pass her that my phone beeps with a text from Rose.
I have made an appointment for you at the family planning clinic tomorrow morning.
I still haven't told Rose she is the reason this baby exists, despite plenty of opportunities. It's not that I think I can keep the baby myself. I understand now that that wouldn't be what's best for the baby. But as for deciding to hand him or her over to Rose, that might take a little more time. After hours of discussing my options over the weekend, Rose and I had decided it would be prudent to visit a family planning clinic. I am aware, of course, that the family planning clinic is not a place to go to plan one's family, but rather a place most people go for the opposite reason, to undo an unplanned family.
Just a visit, Rose had said. We don't need to decide anything right away.
And so, as I turn onto my street, I text a reply to Rose. Okay. When I reach my block of flats, Wally's van is parked outside and the back doors are wide open. Wally is sitting in his folding chair with his computer on his lap, and despite the sunshine, his bobble hat is perched high on his head. He grins when he sees me coming.
Welcome home, he says, reaching for his second fold-up chair, which is tucked into a compartment in the back of the van.
He unfolds it, and I sink into the canvas seat, and for a glorious moment, close my eyes. I am usually on my feet most of the day, but today I feel more tired than usual. After a deep breath, I say, "Do you want children, Wally?" I open my eyes. Wally doesn't seem surprised by the question, but over the course of our short relationship, I have asked him a number of investigative questions as part of, I assume, the normal exploratory process of getting to know someone. Off the top of my head, I can remember asking, "At what age did you start walking? Do you recall ever believing that you could jump off a roof and fly? And why do you think so many people believe in religion?" On no occasion has he ever expressed any concern or issue with my questions, nor does he now. As always, he treats my question with the utmost respect, taking the time to sift through his innermost thoughts before delivering his answer, verdict, or opinion. "No." I feel it in my stomach first. A slight tension, like a gentle punch or squeeze. "A number of reasons have led me to this conclusion," Wally continues, leaning farther back in his seat and winging his elbows behind his head. "For one thing, mental illness. Studies have shown there is a strong genetic link, and anxiety is likely handed down through generations. I would feel awful for inflicting that on a helpless kid." He frowns off into the distance. "Population growth is another of my concerns. People don't understand how bad an issue overpopulation is. Fishless oceans are predicted by 2048. Our planet just does not have the capacity to provide food, water, and adequate shelter for the population numbers we are expecting in the future." He shakes his head sadly. "Finally, the world is not always a kind place, especially if you don't fit the stereotypical mold of what it is to be normal. As you know, it's hard to be a person on the fringes of society. It's hard for me, even as an arguable success. Imagine how hard it would be for a child, particularly a child who doesn't go on to enjoy a level of success in his or her given field. I've already gone through the hardship of being an outlier. I'm not sure I could do it again as a parent." As usual, I am impressed by Wally's response. It is a good argument, well made. So often in life, people speak in riddles, weighing in on both sides of an argument with pros and cons rather than picking a side. Wally doesn't do this. It's one of the reasons I like him so much. So that's it, I think. We agree. A baby is a bad idea.
"Any other questions?"
he asks cheerfully. "That's it, I think."
"Well, I'm just finishing up my work," he says. "Do you want to sit and read for a bit?"
I shake my head. "I have some household administration to attend to." I think I say it too loudly and brightly because Wally gives me a puzzled expression. He keeps watching me all the way to my door. I know because I watch him back. I'm very pleased with myself because I manage to make it all the way into my flat before the tears start to fall. The next day, I trudge to the bus stop. Rose was supposed to drive me to the family planning clinic, but she'd texted a few minutes ago to say she has been held up, and could I make my own way there? I don't mind getting the bus, though I would have appreciated a little warning. Looking up the schedule, walking to the bus stop, these are all things I like to plan for in my schedule, and Rose knows this. It makes me feel an illogical irritation with her. Illogical because Rose had no need to be taking me to the clinic in the first place. Still, the illogical irritation is there. But illogical irritation is something one is allowed to have with one's sister. I have read enough books about sisters to know that is true. On the bus, perhaps as a subconscious act of rebellion, I sit in the seat reserved for people with mobility issues and pregnant women. It will be the one time, I figure, that I'll qualify for this seat. It is peak hour and raining, so it's not long before the seats fill up around me. After a few stops, another pregnant woman gets on, this one at least 7 or 8 months along. I find myself staring at the woman's round belly.
"Excuse me," the woman says, holding her belly. "Do you mind?"
I look at her. "Do I mind what?" She gestures to her belly.
It's just, could I...
"She wants to sit down,"
a man calls from a few rows back. I turn to look at the man, who I notice is making no move to leave his own seat.
Get up, for Christ's sake,
he barks. That seat is for pregnant ladies.
I'm pregnant too, I say when I turn back to the girl, so quietly I can barely hear myself.
Get up,
someone else calls.
What is the matter with you?
The driver pulls over and turns around to see what the commotion is all about.
This woman won't get up for the pregnant lady,
the man from the back of the bus says. The driver looks at me, then at the visibly pregnant woman.
Those seats are reserved for pregnant or disabled passengers, love, he says gently.
I'm pregnant too,
I say louder, standing. My voice sounds funny, as if something has caught in my throat. To my horror, I realize I am crying. I lower my chin and press the button for the next stop. I alight from the bus, even though we are several stops before my destination, and walk the rest of the way to the clinic in the rain. I am soaking wet when I arrive at the clinic. The clinic is behind an innocuous shopfront alongside an optometrist and a barber. I've walked 14 blocks, during which time the rain has not relented for a single second. Still, despite the unexpected bus trip and the walk, I arrive 5 minutes early for the appointment. Rose does not. When I fail to see her standing out front, I feel a distinct note of disappointment. Subconsciously, I'd already handed over the responsibility of announcing my arrival at the desk and filling out any forms to Rose. Instead, I let myself inside into a small waiting room.
May I help you?
The receptionist says to me. She's a grandmotherly sort, probably in her mid-60s, with greying brown hair and lime green eyeglasses on a chain. I ignore her and take a seat. The woman's eyes follow me, but she leaves me be, her eyes returning to her computer after a second or two. The room is about half full. I notice a pair of teenage girls, seemingly without a guardian, a girl of around 18 years of age with her mother, and a couple who look to be in their mid-30s, both weepy-eyed and silent. All of them leaf through magazines, perhaps to distract themselves or to blend in. I don't reach for a magazine. It's never seemed wise to touch communal property at a doctor's office, given the fact that they are little more than conduits for germs. Then again, this doctor's office is a little different from most, and the patients are no more likely to be carrying germs than anyone in an office building. They, like me, are here for a different reason. It's funny how awareness of this slides in and out of focus. One minute I'm fine, and the next, it hits like a sudden, somber surprise. As the clock ticks over to 10:01 a.m., Rose comes bursting through the door, wearing a plum-coloured mohair jumper that makes me itchy just to look at. Though she is carrying an umbrella, her hair is soaking wet. She looks like a different person.
Fern, there you are!
She is surprisingly loud, and everyone in the waiting room looks up from their magazines. The woman behind the desk peers at us over the top of her glasses.
Fern Castle?
She says. Rose looks at me.
You haven't told them your name yet?
No, I say. Much quieter. It's not like Rose to make a spectacle. Rose kneels on the floor in front of me. Everyone else in the waiting room looks back at their magazines, pretending not to pay attention to us.
Good, she says. Because I had a thought this morning. It might sound crazy. Okay, it is crazy.
What is crazy? I ask. I look at the pieces of hair stuck to her face and wonder if it is Rose herself.
It's just, this morning I realized I'd never forgive myself if I didn't ask.
One of the teenage girls isn't even pretending to read her magazine anymore. Instead, she outright stares at us. I stare right back at her, and I am rewarded when she finally looks away. Ask me what? Rose looks around, as if only now noticing the other people in our immediate proximity.
Maybe we should talk somewhere more private?
But what about...
I start to say, but it's too late. Rose is already on her feet on the way to the reception desk to tell the receptionist that we won't be requiring our appointment today. Rose takes me to a cafe not far away from the clinic and orders 2 cups of tea and a scone with jam and cream without even consulting me. It's still raining, the kind of rain that fills up the gutters and makes awnings bulge. It hadn't been forecast, this rain. Everything about today has been a surprise. When the scone arrives, Rose pushes it in front of me.
So, this morning I had an epiphany.
I pick up the scone and examine it. There doesn't seem to be an efficient way to eat it without causing a spillage of jam and cream. In the end, I just lean forward so the spillage will land directly on the plate.
I thought to myself, here I am, desperate to have a baby, while you are pregnant with an unwanted baby. Then it came to me. What if I kept your baby?
My mouth is full of scone. I contemplate spitting it out, but decide there is no graceful way of doing that. So instead, I hold a napkin to my mouth and chew quickly.
Just think about it, Fern. I know it's a lot to take in, so please don't answer me yet. I just thought, maybe this is a way your baby could have the loving family it deserves. I spoke to Owen this morning and...
I swallow. Owen knows? Rose looks guilty.
I hope you don't mind, but when I suggested that he and I might raise the baby, he was over the moon. I shouldn't have done that without speaking to you first.
I sit back in my chair. I like Owen a lot. The idea that the baby could be raised by 2 loving parents, 2 neurotypical loving parents, it's the start to life that every child deserves.
I know that 2 parents isn't everything, Rose says, but I often think about what would have happened to us if we had 2 parents in the picture. When Mum overdosed, we would have had a backup. I would love to give the baby that.
I'd love that too, I say. Rose looks like she is holding her breath, waiting for me to make a decision. But there isn't really a decision to make. It is, after all, what I'd intended in the first place.
Okay,
I say. Rose's eyes fill up with tears. Then she throws her arms around me in another of those straitjacket hugs. Only this time, the wet mohair jumper gets up my nose, so I feel like I'm choking.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. Daniel, we found out, was a commercial pilot. He had been married to Billy's mother, a woman named Trish, for 10 years before they divorced, and they were still on friendly terms. I knew this because Fern asked Daniel about it. Fern had an amazing way of being able to ask these kinds of questions without upsetting people. Even Mum didn't seem to mind when Fern asked why they broke up. Daniel smiled, like this wasn't rude. Like it was, in fact, a very good question.
I travel a lot for work, being a pilot. I think Trish got sick of being alone all the time. And I wasn't always the best husband, let's put it that way. We're much better as co-parents than we were as husband and wife.
It was funny the way he spoke about Trish. With fondness. He never used the kinds of words Mum used to talk about our dad. Deadbeat, loser, dickhead. I wondered how Mum felt about Daniel talking about Trish fondly. Outwardly, she didn't seem bothered by it. But I knew Mum better than that. It would be driving her crazy. But she was on her best behavior around Daniel. She was her same old self when he wasn't around, though. And as strange as it sounds, I preferred it this way. The new, uber-nice Mum was unsettling for sure, but the constant back and forth from nice to horrible gave me whiplash. I was on guard around Daniel at first, naturally. Reassuringly, he was much less interested in Fern and me than Gary had been. He was polite enough, asking about our day at school and appearing genuinely interested in the answer. But he seemed to be far more interested in conversation with Mum than he was with us. He never tickled us or massaged us, or even touched us at all, beyond the offer of a high five every now and again.
He did, however, talk a lot about Billy. Billy, Daniel's son, was 14, and it was clear how much Daniel adored him. Fern and I wanted to meet Billy, and Daniel kept saying we would, soon. Got the feeling he was waiting for something, but I never knew what. It took 6 months before the meeting finally happened. By that time, we were planning a camping trip, at Daniel's suggestion. 3 or 4 days together, he said, so the kids can bond. Mum seemed overjoyed about this, though she'd never showed any interest in camping previously. Fern also seemed happy, and immediately started reading a book about camping. I was the only one who seemed to be bracing for something bad. Why was it that I was always the only one bracing? The fact that we didn't have any camping gear didn't seem to be an obstacle. Daniel simply suggested we go to the shops. I'll admit I was excited about that. Mum never had money to buy much other than food at the shops. And when we needed something else essential, like clothes or crockery, we got it second-hand at an op shop. But even more exciting than buying something new was the fact that Billy was coming with us to buy the tent. Daniel had told us a lot about him by then, and Billy had built up an almost mythical status in my mind, not to mention the fact that I was 12 at the time, and boys were fast becoming something that interested me. When we pulled up outside Billy's mum's very nice house, Billy was waiting on the manicured nature strip. He wore jeans, a hoodie, and a baseball cap. His head was down, and he was chewing a fingernail aggressively. His mum was by his side, with her hand on his shoulder, and she waved at the approaching car. "Hello," she said to us when Billy opened the door to get in. She looked both Fern and me in the eye. "I'm Trish, Billy's mum. You must be the twins. Let me guess, you're Fern and you're Rose." Fern and I stared at her as if she was an alien. We had never met a woman like Trish before. She was different from Mum. Fatter and frecklier, with a round face and a gummy smile. Another difference was her obvious adoration of Billy. Before he got into the car, she planted several kisses on his cheek, which he wiped off as Fern leaned over and touched her bracelet against mine. I frowned at her. "What is it?" But she kept her gaze on Billy. "Be good for your dad," Billy's mum said, as he slid into the back seat, taking his place beside me. Billy had a round face, green eyes, and hair that was swept over his face. He grinned at me. "Hey." "Hey," I replied. "What kind of tent are we going to get, kids?" Daniel said as we began driving. "I've taken the liberty of doing some research," Fern said. She had her camping book in her lap, as well as a handful of flyers from camping stores. "For a family of 5, hands down the best option is the Montana 12. It features near vertical sides and a very spacious 3-room interior with zippered dividers and a 3rd removable wall so you can further divide one of the end rooms into 2 smaller compartments. It also features a large front awning with built-in sidewalls that allows you to create a big veranda at the front of your tent. Or if we want separate tents, I have recommendations for those too." "Someone has done her research," Daniel said. "Glad someone around here has," Billy said. Daniel laughed good-naturedly. It was hard not to be buoyed by the sense of camaraderie in the car. It looked like Billy and Daniel were going to stick around, at least for a little while. That had to be a good thing. Still, as I heard Mum's tinkling laugh, I felt that familiar sense of dread. "Something is going to ruin this," I thought. If there's one thing I knew about Mum, it was that she had a gift for destroying everything good. Fern. For the next week, Rose is around constantly. She shows up in the morning to offer me a ride to work. She appears in the evening with a homemade meal. She drops off flyers about prenatal yoga and hypnobirthing. She phones and texts on an hourly basis simply to check in. In the past, Rose always respected my desire for forewarning,
always having a scheduled plan, never showing up without announcing it first. Not anymore. But as it turns out, her visits are fortuitous. Because just about every time Rose shows up, she averts a crisis. Confiscating soft cheese and deli meat from the fridge, which apparently was liable to give me listeria and kill the baby. Or dropping in when I was at work and finding I had left my oil burner on. Which was strange, as I rarely use my oil burner anymore.
It's a good thing I was here, she always says.
The one time I can count on Rose to leave me alone is when I go to visit Mum. So I feel a strange sense of relief that Thursday, as I stride through the automatic doors of Sun Meadows. I take the stairs up to Mum's room. Teresa, Mum's speech therapist, is there again. And Mum is in her usual chair, her tray table beside her, a chocolate iced donut sitting on it alongside a cup of water. I watch from the door for a minute. Teresa is holding open what looks like a children's picture storybook.
The cow jumps over the moon,
Mum says.
Very good, Teresa says.
Thank you.
Very, very good, I say from the door. Mum looks at me and beams.
Pop it.
Great timing, as usual, Teresa says. We're finishing up. She's doing a great job. Just before you arrived, she told me she was thirsty. I brought her a drink of water and she asked for ice. By next week, she'll be reading novels aloud.
That seems a stretch, I say. Teresa chuckles as I sit down on a chair beside Mum. Mum has a bit of chocolate on her lip, and I lean forward to wipe it off.
It's good to see you,
Mum says. Teresa gives me the thumbs up gesture. She waits for a moment as if expecting something in response, so I mimic her gesture. She grins, and I focus my attention back on Mum.
It's good to see you too,
I say. It's true. It is good to see her. Especially today, when I'm feeling all twisted up inside. When you feel like that, there really is nothing quite like seeing your mum. Mum has always been a good listener. Even before the accident. On the odd occasion, she could even be wise. I have a memory of talking to her once after being excluded from a birthday party in grade 3. I didn't want to go, obviously. Parties were always loud, with music and bright colours and squealing. Worst of all, there were almost always balloons. Balloons ranked high on my list of terrors, given their tendency to pop at unpredictable times and elicit a loud bang. But every other girl in the class had been invited, including Rose. So I was upset.
I understand why you're upset, Mum had said. It's one thing deciding not to go, but it's quite another being told you can't.
It had been indescribably gratifying to be understood like that. I yearn for the same sort of wisdom from her today. I'm pregnant, Mum, I say. I look at her to see if she registers this, and I see, from the way her forehead wrinkles, that she does. Remember the boy I told you about? I say. And she nods. Well, one thing led to another and I'm pregnant. Anyway, obviously I can't look after a baby myself, so I'm going to give the baby to Rose. I say it fast, perhaps too fast, as it comes out a little wobbly. But I know Mum understands because her eyes widen. Rose can't have a baby, I explain. She has bad ovaries. Premature ovarian aging, it's called. And I'm pregnant, so it makes sense that I should give my baby to her. Right?
Why can't you?
I lower my voice. You know why I can't keep it, Mum. It would be dangerous. Mum still doesn't speak. But after a minute or two, I notice her becoming red in the face. For a second, I think she's choking. I hand her the cup of water, but she waves it away. She opens her mouth and chokes something out. And though I'm straining to listen, I can't make it out.
What?
What did you say, Mum?
She stares at me very intently, even though she knows I prefer less eye contact, to make sure I'm listening, and says,
"Your baby. Don't give it to Rose."
The next afternoon, I am reshelving books at the library and thinking about what Mum said. "Don't give my baby to Rose?" I'd repeated, looking for confirmation. But Mum just shook her head, which might have meant I was right or wrong. She'd said a few things after that, but nothing that made much sense. It was like she regressed in front of my eyes. As such, I suspect it would be silly to give much credence to what she said.
"Can I get some help over here?"
I glance up. The man who is speaking, an elderly chap with an extraordinarily large head covered in liver spots, doesn't bother to get up from the computer where he is stationed. "What is the problem?" I call from several meters away.
"My granddaughter set me up with an email address," he bellows. "But I don't know how to check if I have any mail."
I glance around for Gail or Linda or Trevor, even Carmel. They've all disappeared. Traitors. The man crosses his hairy, meaty forearms in front of his chest and glares at me. I wonder if it's too late to make up an excuse and walk off. I sigh. "What's your email address?"
"I don't know."
He throws one hairy arm in the air.
something@something.com. Sounds ridiculous to me, quite frankly.
"Right, well, we do run introductory computer courses on Tuesday evenings."
"I play bridge on Tuesday evenings."
"Or you can schedule a private lesson for a time of your choosing."
"Perfect," he says. "I choose now."
He stares me down. I stare right back. This old guy doesn't know who he's dealing with. "Fern?" I turn, sagging in relief. Carmel has turned up at the 11th hour. "Ah, Carmel. This gentleman is having some trouble with his email."
"Someone is here to see you,"
Carmel says, her eyes flicking to the entrance of the library. I glance over and see Wally standing there, carrying a large bunch of sunflowers. My heart skips a beat.
"Are you going to help with the email or not?" the old man barks. "I don't have all day."
Wally lifts his hand in a wave. He is wearing a navy suit. It must be new. I've seen him in a charcoal-coloured suit before, which was also very nice, but not as tight in the trousers. His hair is also combed with a side part, which looks very dapper. Very old Hollywood.
"Fern, you've overstayed your shift," Carmel says. "Why don't you get going and I'll help this gentleman with the computer?"
I look at the clock. I haven't overstayed my shift. I'm closing and there's 20 minutes until...
"Fern," she says firmly, "you have overstayed your shift."
Carmel sounds most bizarre, like a kind of serial killer robot. Her stare is also uncomfortably intense. My instinct is to ask if she's all right, and also to correct her again, as I most certainly haven't overstayed my shift. But I have grave fears this may send her into some sort of episode, and so I acquiesce.
"Okay," I reply. "Thank you, Carmel."
Wally's van is in the parking lot, and once we reach it, he opens the passenger door for me. A gallant gesture which makes me feel rather good. I climb inside and place the sunflowers beside me on the bench seat. They are wrapped in brown paper with a small water-filled plastic bag tied around the stems to keep them hydrated, which is a rather innovative design. No one has ever given me flowers before. To be honest, I've always felt they were a little indulgent, and I've always been fearful that the smell would be cloying. I am surprised to find that, on this occasion, I couldn't be more pleased with them. And even in the restricted space of the van, the smell is reasonably inoffensive. "Thank you for the flowers," I say when Wally gets into the driver's side of the van.
"You're welcome,"
Wally says, smiling at a spot over my shoulder.
Sunflowers haven't got a strong scent. In fact, the florist said unscented, but I detected a faint odor.
I conjure an image of Wally in the florist pointing at posies, sniffing each bunch and shaking his head until he declared the sunflowers the perfect bunch. It's a happy image. It makes me smile.
Now, if you'll allow it, I'd like to take you to dinner, he says.
Instantly, my florist fantasy dissipates, replaced by another, less appealing one. Wally and me in a crowded restaurant, shouting to be heard over the music. Pungent dishes and intoxicated diners. I open my mouth to explain to Wally that I can't possibly go out for dinner, that restaurants are among the worst places for overstimulation. But he holds up a hand, silencing me.
Hear me out. A guy that I know runs a Greek restaurant in Windsor. They are hosting a private function tonight in their upstairs room, so the main dining room is closed. He's agreed to open it, just for us.
I frown. What do you mean?
We will be the only ones in the restaurant. We can choose the lighting, the music, the food, everything.
Slowly, it starts to sink in. What Wally has done. Not just the flowers, but all of it. An entire evening. All coordinated to be perfect. For me, it is an entirely unprecedented level of thoughtful.
Why are you crying?
He asks. I reach up and touch my face, which is indeed wet. I'm just a little overwhelmed, I think. This is so lovely. A restaurant. I didn't think I'd ever be able to go to a restaurant. In my peripheral vision, I see Wally smile softly. What does one even wear to a restaurant? I ask. I gesture to my denim overalls. Can I go like this?
You could, he says. But I brought you something that I thought you might like to wear instead.
He reaches into the back seat and brings back a white plastic bag. There's more?
I reach into the bag and retrieve a long halter-neck dress with diagonal stripes. Each stripe is a unique color. Not one is doubled up.
It must include every single color and shade on earth.
I saw this in a shop and it made me think of you,
Wally says. It is the most beautiful dress I have ever seen. I change in the back of the van. The dress fits, though the fabric is a little scratchy. It matches perfectly with the rainbows on my sneakers.
Beautiful,
Wally says when I appear in the front seat. On a whim, I swish the skirt a little bit to show off, but I immediately feel silly and stop. Wally drives to the restaurant, carefully adhering to the road signs and speed limits, which I appreciate. As we drive, I take a minute to reflect on the fact that I'm going on a proper date. To a restaurant. It is like a dream. Except I've never had dreams like this. It's like the books I've read. The happy ones. Where things work out. We pull up in front of the restaurant. But before I can open the car door, Wally places a hand on my arm.
There's one more thing.
He leans over and opens the glove compartment.
These are noise-canceling and Bluetooth connected, so we can hear each other, he says,
handing me a pair of giant headphones that look like earmuffs.
And these?
He hands me a pair of swimming goggles in pink and purple and aqua, and pulls out another pair of bright green goggles for himself.
I think are fairly self-explanatory.
He pulls the green ones over his face.
What do you think?
You look like an aviator frog, I say. I pull on my own goggles. What about me?
A rainbow aviator frog.
I smile. As promised, the restaurant is quiet and the lighting is low. We are greeted by a waitress with a nose ring, purple hair, and a tattoo of a dragon creeping out of the chest area of her white button-down shirt, and yet she stares at us when we arrive.
Reservation for Wally,
Wally says. I snort. The waitress leads us to a table set with a white tablecloth and bright blue chairs. As we sit down, the waitress hands each of us a laminated menu,
and fills our water glasses from a porcelain jug. The restaurant smells of garlic and meat.
Are you okay? Wally says.
I nod. It's lovely.
Wally looks so funny in his goggles, I let out another snort. What? Wally says.
Nothing. The waitress brings over pita bread and tzatziki and tells us she'll be back in a minute to take our order.
I dive into the bread before it's even hit the table. This pregnancy hunger is no joke. I feel like I could eat every carbohydrate in the place.
Did you miss lunch?
Wally asks as I dip my second piece of pita.
I am grateful to have a mouthful, so I can just smile and shrug.
I can't tell him, of course, that I missed neither lunch nor afternoon tea. I can't tell him, because then he might ask more questions and find out that I'm pregnant. As I swallow my next mouthful, I become aware of sounds drifting down the stairs. Soft music, chairs scraping, intermittent laughter. It's not overwhelming, but I can hear it even with my earphones on. I'm about to ask Wally if he knows what is happening up there, when the waitress appears to take our order. Wally and I remove our headphones long enough to order a lamb souvlaki for Wally and baked Greek fries with meatballs for me. We also order bread and hummus, olives and water. Music starts up above, slightly louder than before. I replace my headphones.
So, I say to Wally, was there a particular purpose to this evening, or was it just...
I stumble on the juvenile-sounding word.
A date. As a matter of fact, there was a purpose. A celebration. I've created an ad hoc version of follow-up.
Ad hoc version. I fear I ought to understand this reference. Over the past few weeks, Wally has explained the process of creating and launching an app. But each time, despite the clarity and simplicity of his explanations, I invariably found myself tuning out after a minute or two, and the constant nausea has done nothing to assist my concentration.
It means the app is ready for testing, Wally explains. I've spent the last few weeks coding, and I think it's going to work. With Shout, it took us 5 times as long to get to this point, but I've been so motivated. And a lot of that is to do with you being in my life. And so, I wanted to do something special for you.
Wally smiles at me, and it becomes entirely and undeniably clear that I cannot break up with Wally. The fact that I thought I could feels like mere madness.
Fern?
Wally says.
What is it?
I have to tell you something, I say.
Damn,
Wally says, removing his headphones.
I can't hear you. I think my battery ran out.
I take off my own headphones and place them on the table. The music upstairs is louder now, and I can hear stomping on the ceiling above. I said, I have to tell you something. Wally leans forward, his face a mask of concern.
What is it?
I open my mouth, and a bomb goes off. Right there in the restaurant. I drop to the floor. The noise is ear-splitting. I clamber under the table, covering my head with my hands. I've barely recovered from the first explosion before there is another. And another. Bizarrely, music continues to play. I search for Wally under the table, gripping his hands as I hear another explosion. I wrap my arms around myself and rock back and forth, waiting for it to end.
I'm sorry, Wally says once he's bundled me outside. I had no idea it was a wedding upstairs.
I am still shaking so much I can't stand up straight. The terrifying smashing noise reverberates in my head.
They were smashing plates. It's customary at Greek weddings. I didn't think of it.
Plates? That's what that deafening noise was? People smashing plates?
I'm so sorry.
Wally looks like he might cry.
I thought I'd thought of everything.
The waitress comes out of the restaurant with paper napkins and a glass of water. Is she all right? She says to Wally. Should I call a doctor?
Wally brushes a strand of hair behind my ear. Do you need a doctor?
No, I say. The waitress nods and after a minute goes back inside.
Wally remains by my side. What can I get you? He says. How can I help? I take a deep breath and look at him. Can you please call Rose? Rose screeches to the curb so fast that Wally and I have to lift our feet from the gutter to avoid getting run over. She gets out and slams the car door, shooting a dark glare at Wally. What the hell happened? Wally and I stagger to our feet. I had finally stopped shaking, but I suddenly start again. Rose looks so angry. We went out for dinner, I say.
In a restaurant? You know you can't handle that environment.
She looks at Wally.
You know she has sensory processing issues, don't you? She's hypersensitive to sound and light and touch.
And smell, I add. She looks back at me as if seeing me for the first time.
What on earth are you wearing?
Goggles. There was no one else at the restaurant.
Well, evidently there was. Jesus! Fern, let's just get out of here.
Rose looks into the restaurant at the waitress who is having a good gawk at us through the window.
Have you paid the bill?
I look at Wally. Not yet, he says. I was distracted. I'll do it now.
For God's sake, I'll do it.
Rose stalks into the restaurant, unzipping her purse.
The last thing we need is for you to be arrested.
Wally stands up, but by the time he is on his feet, she is already gone. He looks at me. I'm so sorry, Fern.
No, I'm sorry.
He shakes his head. I had no idea it would be so...
difficult.
Yeah, difficult. There is a brief silence when no cars drive past.
Why can't I just be normal?
I whisper. You are. It's everyone else who are weirdos. We smile at each other sadly. After a moment, Rose comes out of the restaurant.
Say your goodbyes,
she says, taking me by the arm and putting me into the passenger seat of her car. It feels so different from Wally opening the door for me earlier. Then, I felt like a woman. Now, I feel like a child. As we pull away, Wally gives me a weak smile. I can't help but smile back. He is still wearing his goggles.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. We drove to the campsite in Daniel's car, listening to the Traveling Wilburys. Fern and I didn't know the band, but we picked up the words quickly. And it was actually kind of fun, all of us singing along like that. Daniel had sweets in the console that he passed back at intervals to Fern and Billy, who ate them eagerly. He also had cans of Coca-Cola. I still remember him holding out the red can for one of us to grab, and Fern and me staring at it. We'd never drunk Coke. It wasn't just because of my diabetes. Mum said it was full of chemicals that would rot our teeth and give us cancer. But there was Daniel, offering us a can, waggling it impatiently, waiting for one of us to take it. I could have blamed my blood sugar, but something told me that would be the wrong thing to do. I saw Fern open her mouth to say something, probably that Mum didn't like us drinking Coke, so I quickly beat her to it.
Thank you, Daniel,
I jumped in, taking the can. Mum caught my eye, and I knew I did good. Different rules for different situations, that was her mantra. Still, neither of us drank the Coke. We arrived at the campsite before dark and unpacked in a flurry before we lose the light. Like the drive, I quite enjoyed it. The feeling of being part of something, working together as a team. Us against the light. Fern and I set up our own tent with impressive speed, mostly because Fern had memorized the instructions. We finished so quickly that we were also able to help Mum and Daniel pitch their tent, which was much more complex, and then collect a huge pile of kindling before dark. Billy set up his own tent, then sat on a log while the rest of us worked. Daniel commented that Fern and I were born for camping, while Billy was born for laziness, and Mum smiled a lot. Even when Daniel wasn't looking. Once the tents were set up, Daniel cooked some sausages and corn on the cob over a little camping stove, and we ate them with bread sitting around the campfire. Afterward, Mum and Daniel disappeared into their tent, so Fern and I went to ours. We had just got settled when we heard the rustling of twigs outside the tent. We didn't even have time to exchange a glance before the zip lowered and Billy's face appeared in the gap. "Anyone for poker?" Fern and I broke into a chorus of gasps and shushes. "We'll get in trouble," I cried, horrified, and if I'm honest, a bit exhilarated. Mum and Daniel's tent was just meters away, and Mum's hearing was ridiculous. At home, Fern and I had learned how to have entirely soundless conversations by mouthing words for this exact reason. But if Billy was afraid of being reprimanded, he hid it well. He crawled into our tent, a torch in one hand, a deck of cards in the other. "They won't hear us. They've already sunk a bottle and a half of wine." He reached outside the tent and retrieved a can of beer. "But they didn't drink this."
"What are you doing?" I whispered. "Put that back."
He opened the can and took a swig. Fern and I were scandalized.
"They'll know," I cried. "You'll get into trouble."
He shrugged. "So, are we playing?" I looked at Fern, whose eyes were cautious. "How do you play?" I asked. Fern knew, of course, but I didn't have the slightest idea. "I'll teach you," Billy said, taking another swig from the can. "We can be on the same team. Scooch up." Billy crawled over to sit beside me and gave me a conspiratorial wink. His sense of fun was infectious. As we played, his wrist rested on my knee so we could both see the cards. I'd never been so close to a boy in all my life. Periodically, he leaned closer and whispered something to me, the rules, or whether or not he thought Fern was bluffing. And I smelled his scent, a mix of spearmint chewing gum, beer, and smoke from the campfire. He couldn't convince either of us to try the beer, so he polished off the can on his own. He didn't even slur his words. Billy and I lost the game of poker that night, but I didn't care one bit. For a couple of hours, it felt like I'd tripped a